Disc 7.
The Dragon Banner of Wessex was flying on the summit of a long, low hill that lay athwart our road. To reach Ebenduna, which evidently lay a short way beyond the hill and was hidden by it, we would need to attack up the slope and across that ridge of open grassland. But to the north, where the hills fell away to the River Thames, there was a track along the river, which suggested we might skirt the enemy position. To stop us, he would need come down the hill and give battle on level ground. Halfdan called the Danish leaders together, and they talked for a long time, evidently disagreeing about what should be done. Some men wanted to attack uphill and scatter the enemy where they were, but others advised fighting the West Saxons in the flat river meadows. And in the end, Earl Guthrum the Unlucky persuaded them to do both. That, of course, meant splitting our army into two. But even so, I thought it was a clever idea. Ragnar Guthrum and the two earls Sidroc would go down to the lower ground, thus threatening to pass by the enemy-held hill, while Halfdan with Harald and Bagseg would stay on the high ground and advance toward the dragon banner on the ridge. That way the enemy might hesitate to attack Ragnar for fear that Halfdan's troops would fall on their rear. Most likely, Ragnar said, the enemy would decide not to fight at all, but instead retreat to Ebenduna, where we could besiege them. "Better to have them penned in a fortress than roaming around," he said cheerfully. "Better still," Ravan commented dryly, "not to divide the army." "They're only West Saxons," Ragnar said dismissively. It was already afternoon, and because it was winter, the day was short, so there was not much time, though Ragnar thought there was more than enough daylight remaining to finish off Ethelred's troops. Men touched their charms, kissed sword hilts, hefted shields. Then we were marching down the hill, going off the chalk grasslands into the river valley. Once there, we were half hidden by the leafless trees, but now and again I could glimpse Halfdan's men advancing along the hill crests, and I could see there were West Saxon troops waiting for them, which suggested that Guthrum's plan was working, and that we could march clear around the enemy's northern flank. "What we do then," Ragnar said, "is climb up behind them, and the bastards will be trapped. We'll kill them all." "One of them has to stay alive," Ravan said. "One? Why?" "To tell the tale, of course. Look for their poet. He'll be handsome. Find him and let him live." Ragnar laughed. There were, I suppose, about 800 of us, slightly fewer than the contingent that had stayed with Halfdan, and the enemy army was probably slightly larger than our two forces combined, but we were all warriors, and many of the West Saxon Ferd were farmers forced to war, and so we saw nothing but victory. Then, as our leading troops marched out of an oak wood, we saw the enemy had followed our example and divided their own army into two. One half was waiting on the hill for Halfdan, while the other half had come to meet us. Alfred led our opponents. I knew that because I could see Beorka's red hair, and later on I glimpsed Alfred's long, anxious face in the fighting. His brother, King Ethelred, had stayed on the heights, where instead of waiting for Halfdan to assault him, he was advancing to make his own attack. The Saxons, it seemed, were avid for battle. So we gave it to them. Our forces made shield wedges to attack their shield wall. We called on Odin. We howled our war cries. We charged. And the West Saxon line did not break. It did not buckle, but instead held fast. And so the slaughter work began. Ravan told me time and again that destiny was everything. Fate rules. The three spinners sit at the foot of the tree of life, and they make our lives, and we are their playthings. And though we think we make our own choices, all our fates are in the spinners' threads. Destiny is everything. And that day, though I did not know it, my destiny was spun. Weird bith full arid. Fate is unstoppable. What is there to say of the battle that the West Saxons said happened at a place they call Aesk's Hill? I assume Aesk was the thane who had once owned the land, and his fields received a rich tilth of blood and bone that day. The poet could fill 1,000 lines telling what happened. But battle is battle. Men die. In the shield wall it is sweat, terror, cramp, half blows, full blows, screaming and cruel death. There were really 2 battles at Aske's Hill. The one above and the other below, and the deaths came swiftly. Harald and Bagseg died. Sidrock the Older watched his son die and then was cut down himself. And with him died Earl Osburn and Earl Fryenna, and so many other good warriors. And the Christian priests were calling on their god to give the West Saxon sword strength. And that day Odin was sleeping and the Christian god was awake. We were driven back. On top of the hill and in the valley we were driven back. And it was only the weariness of the enemy that stopped a full slaughter and let our survivors retreat from the fight, leaving their companions behind in their death blood. Toki was one of them. The shipmaster, so full of sword skill, died in the ditch behind which Alfred's shield wall had waited for us. Ragnar, blood all over his face, and with enemy's blood matted in his unbound hair, could not believe it. The West Saxons were jeering. The West Saxons had fought like fiends, like men inspired, like men who know their whole future rested on a winter afternoon's work, and they had beaten us. Destiny is all. We were defeated and went back to Redingham.
Chapter 6. These days, whenever Englishmen talk of the Battle of Aske's Hill, they speak of God giving the West Saxons the victory because King Ethelred and his brother Alfred were praying when the Danes appeared. Maybe they are right. I can well believe that Alfred was praying, but it helped that he chose his position well. His shield wall was just beyond a deep, winter-flooded ditch, and the Danes had to fight their way up from that mud-bottomed trough, and they died as they came. And men who would rather have been farmers than warriors beat off an assault of sword Danes. And Alfred led the farmers, encouraged them, told them they could win, and put his faith in God. I think the ditch was the reason that he won, but he would doubtless have said that God dug the ditch. Halfdan lost as well. He was attacking uphill, climbing a smooth, gentle slope. But it was late in the day and the sun was in his men's eyes, or so they said afterward. And King Ethelred, like Alfred, encouraged his men so well that they launched a howling downhill attack that bit deep into Halfdan's ranks, that became discouraged when they saw the lower army retreating from Alfred's stubborn defence. There were no angels with fiery swords present, despite what the priests now say. At least I saw none. There was a waterlogged ditch. There was a battle. The Danes lost, and destiny changed. I did not know the Danes could lose, but at 14 years old I learned that lesson, and for the first time I heard Saxon cheers and jeers, and something hidden in my soul stirred. And we went back to Redingham. There was plenty more fighting as winter turned to spring, and spring to summer. New Danes came with the new year, and our ranks were thus restored, and we won all our subsequent encounters with the West Saxons, twice fighting them at Basingus, in Hamptonshire, then at Meryton, which was in Wiltonshire, and thus deep inside their territory, and again in Wiltonshire, at Wilton. And each time we won, which meant we held the battlefield at day's end. But at none of those clashes did we destroy the enemy. Instead, we wore each other out, fought each other to a bloody standstill, and as summer caressed the land, we were no nearer conquering Wessex than we had been at Yule. But we did manage to kill King Ethelred. That happened at Wilton, where the king received a deep axe wound to his left shoulder, and though he was hurried from the field, and though priests and monks prayed over his sickbed, and though cunning men treated him with herbs and leeches, he died after a few days. And he left an heir, an Aethling, Aethelwold. He was Prince Aethelwold, eldest son of Ethelred, but he was not old enough to be his own master. For like me, he was only 14. Yet even so, some men proclaimed his right to be named the King of Wessex. But Alfred had far more powerful friends, and he deployed the legend of the Pope having invested him as the future king. The legend must have worked its magic, for sure enough, at the meeting of the Wessex Witan, which was the assembly of nobles, bishops, and powerful men, Alfred was acclaimed as the new king. Perhaps the Witan had no choice. Wessex, after all, was desperately fighting off Halfdan's forces, and it would have been a bad time to make a boy into a king. Wessex needed a leader, and so the Witan chose Alfred. And Ethelwold and his younger brother were whisked off to an abbey, where they were told to get on with their lessons. "Alfred should have murdered the little bastards," Ragnar told me cheerfully. And he was probably right. So Alfred, the youngest of six brothers, was now the King of Wessex. The year was 871. I did not know it then, but Alfred's wife had just given birth to a daughter he named Ethelflaed. Ethelflaed was 14 years younger than me, and even if I had known of her birth, I would have dismissed it as unimportant. But destiny is all. The spinners work and we do their will, whether we will it or not. Alfred's first act as king, other than to bury his brother and put his nephews away in a monastery and have himself crowned and go to church 100 times and weary God's ears with unceasing prayers, was to send messengers to Halfdan, proposing a conference. He wanted peace, it seemed, and as it was midsummer, and we were no nearer to victory than we had been at midwinter, Halfdan agreed to the meeting. And so, with his army's leaders and a bodyguard of picked men, he went to Bavum. I went too, with Ragnar, Raven and Breda. Rorik, still sick, stayed in Reddingham, and I was sorry he did not see Bavum, for though it was only a small town, it was almost as marvellous as London. There was a bath in the town centre, not a small tub, but an enormous building with pillars and a crumbling roof above a great stone hollow that was filled with hot water. The water came from the underworld, and Ragnar was certain that it was heated by the forges of the dwarves. The bath, of course, had been built by the Romans, as had all the other extraordinary building in Bathum's valley. Not many men wanted to get into the bath, because they feared water, even though they loved their ships. But Breda and I went in, and I discovered she could swim like a fish. I clung to the edge and marvelled at the strange experience of having hot water all over my naked skin. Beoka found us there. The centre of Bathum was covered by a truce, which meant no man could carry weapons there, and West Saxons and Danes mixed amicably enough in the streets, so there was nothing to stop Beoka searching for me. He came to the bath with two other priests, both gloomy-looking men with running noses, and they watched as Beoka leaned down to me. "I saw you come in here," he said. Then he noticed Breda, who was swimming underwater, her long black hair streaming. She reared up, and he could not miss her small breasts, and he recoiled as though she were the devil's handmaid. "She's a girl, Atred." "I know," I said. "Naked." "God is good," I said. He stepped forward to slap me, but I pushed myself away from the edge of the bath, and he nearly fell in. The other two priests were staring at Breda. God knows why. They probably had wives, but priests, I've found, get very excited about women. So do warriors, but we do not shake like aspens just because a girl shows us her tits. Beoka tried to ignore her, though that was difficult because Breda swam up behind me and put her arms around my waist. "You must slip away," Beoka whispered to me.
"Slip away?
From the pagans. Come to our quarters, we'll hide you."
"Who is he?"
Breda asked me. She spoke in Danish. "He was a priest I knew at home," I said.
"Ugly, isn't he?" she said.
"You have to come," Beoka hissed at me. "We need you."
"You need me?"
He leaned even closer.
"There's unrest in Northumbria, Atred. You must have heard what happened."
He paused to make the sign of the cross.
"All those monks and nuns slaughtered. They were murdered. A terrible thing, Atred.
But God will not be mocked. There is to be a rising in Northumbria, and Alfred will encourage it. If we can say that Atred of Bebbanburg is on our side, it will help." I doubted it would help at all. I was 14 and hardly old enough to inspire men into making suicidal attacks on Danish strongholds. "She's not a Dane," I told Beoka. who I did not think would have said these things if he believed Breeder could understand them. "She's from East Anglia." He stared at her. "East Anglia?" I nodded, then let mischief have its way. "She's the niece of King Edmund," I lied. And Breeder giggled and ran a hand down my body to try and make me laugh. Beoka made the sign of the cross again. "Poor man. A martyr. Poor girl." Then he frowned. "But," he began, then stopped, quite incapable of understanding why the dreaded Danes allowed two of their prisoners to frolic naked in a bath of hot water. Then he closed his squinty eyes, because he saw where Breeder's hand had come to rest. "We must get you both out of here," he said urgently, "to a place where you can learn God's ways." "I should like that," I said, and Breeder squeezed so hard that I almost cried out in pain. "Our quarters are to the south of here," Beoka said, "across the river and on top of the hill. Go there, Atrid, and we shall take you away. Both of you." Of course, I did no such thing. I told Ragnar, who laughed at my invention, that Breeder was King Edmund's niece, and shrugged at the news that there would be an uprising in Northumbria. "There are always rumours of revolts," he said, "and they all end the same way." "He was very certain," I said. "All it means is that they've sent monks to stir up trouble. I doubt it will amount to much. Anyway, once we've settled Alfred, we can go back. Go home, eh?" But settling with Alfred was not as easy as Halfdan or Ragnar had supposed. It was true that Alfred was the supplicant, and that he wanted peace because the Danish forces had been raiding deep into Wessex, but he was not ready to collapse as Burgred had yielded in Mercia. When Halfdan proposed that Alfred stay king, but that the Danes occupy the chief West Saxon fort, Alfred threatened to walk out and continue the war. "You insult me," he said calmly. "If you wish to take the fortresses, then come and take them."
"We will," Halfdan threatened, and Alfred merely shrugged as if to say the Danes were welcome to try.
But Halfdan knew, as all the Danes knew, that their campaign had failed. It was true that we had scoured large swathes of Wessex. We had taken much treasure, slaughtered or captured livestock, burned mills and homes and churches. But the price had been high. Many of our best men were dead, or else so badly wounded that they would be forced to live off their lord's charity for the rest of their days. We had also failed to take a single West Saxon fortress, which meant that when winter came we would be forced to withdraw to the safety of Lundain or Mercia. Yet if the Danes were exhausted by the campaign, so were the West Saxons. They had also lost many of their best men. They had lost treasure, and Alfred was worried that the Britons, the ancient enemy who had been defeated by his ancestors, might flood out of their fastnesses in Wales and Cornwallum. Yet Alfred would not succumb to his fears. He would not meekly give in to Halfdan's demands, though he knew he must meet some of them. And so the bargaining went on for a week, and I was surprised by Alfred's stubbornness. He was not an impressive man to look at. There was something spindly about him, and his long face had a weak cast. But that was a deception. He never smiled as he faced Halfdan. He rarely took those clever brown eyes off his enemy's face. He pressed his point tediously, and he was always calm, never raising his voice, even when the Danes were screaming at him. "What we want," he explained again and again, "is peace. You need it, and it is my duty to give it to my country. So you will leave my country." His priests, Beoka among them, wrote down every word, filling precious sheets of parchment with endless lines of script. They must have used every drop of ink in Wessex to record that meeting, and I doubt anyone ever read the whole record. Not that the meetings went on all day. Alfred insisted they could not start until he had attended church, and he broke at midday for more prayer, and he finished before sundown so that he could return to the church. How that man prayed. But his patient bargaining was just as remorseless. And in the end, Halfdan agreed to evacuate Wessex, but only on payment of 6,000 pieces of silver, and to make sure it was paid, he insisted that his forces must remain in Redingham,
where Alfred was required to deliver 3 wagons of fodder daily and 5 wagons of rye grain. When the silver was paid, Halfdan promised the ships would slide back down the Thames and Wessex would be free of pagans. Alfred argued against allowing the Danes to stay in Redingham, insisting that they withdraw east of Lundain, but in the end, desperate for peace, he accepted that they could remain in the town, and so, with solemn oaths on both sides, the peace was made. I was not there when the conference ended, nor was Breeder. We had been there most days, serving as ravens' eyes in the big Roman hall where the talking went on, but when we got bored, or rather when Raven was tired of our boredom, we would go to the bath and swim. I loved that water. We were swimming on the day before the talking finished. There were just the two of us in the great echoing chamber. I liked to stand where the water gushed in from a hole in the stone, letting it cascade over my long hair, and I was standing there, eyes closed, when I heard Breeder squeal. I opened my eyes, and just then a pair of strong hands gripped my shoulders. My skin was slippery, and I twisted away, but a man in a leather coat jumped in the bath, told me to be quiet, and seized me again. 2 other men were wading across the pool, using long staves to shepherd Breeder to the water's edge. "What are you—" I began to ask, using Danish. "Quiet, boy," one of the men answered. He was a West Saxon, and there were 12 of them, and when they had pulled our wet, naked bodies out of the water, they wrapped us in big, stinking cloaks, scooped up our clothes and hurried us away. I shouted for help and was rewarded by a thump on my head that might have stunned an ox. We were pushed over the saddles of 2 horses, and then we travelled for some time with men mounted behind us, and the cloaks were only taken off at the top of the big hill that overlooks Batham from the south. And there, beaming at us, was Beoka. "You are rescued, Lord," he said to me. "Praise Almighty God, you are rescued! As are you, my lady," he added to Breeder. I could only stare at him. Rescued? Kidnapped, more like. Breeder looked at me, and I at her, and she gave the smallest shake of her head, as if to suggest we should keep silent. At least I took it to mean that, and did so. Then Beoka told us to get dressed. I had slipped my hammer amulet and my arm rings into my belt pouch when I undressed, and I left them there as Beoka hurried us into a nearby church, little more than a wood and straw shack that was no bigger than a peasant's pigsty, and there he gave thanks to God for our deliverance. Afterward he took us to a nearby hall, where we were introduced to Earlswith, Alfred's wife, who was attended by 12 women, 3 of them nuns, and guarded by 10 of heavily armed men. Earlswith was a small woman, with mouse-brown hair, small eyes, a small mouth and a very determined chin. She was wearing a blue dress that had angels embroidered in silver thread about its skirt and about the hem of its wide sleeves, and she wore a heavy crucifix of gold. A baby was in a wooden cradle beside her, and later, much later, I realised that the baby must have been Ethelflaed. So that was the very first time I ever saw her, though I thought nothing of it at the time. Earlswith welcomed me, speaking in the distinctive tones of a Mercian, and after she had inquired about my parentage, she told me we had to be related because her father was Ethelred, who had been an ealdorman in Mercia, and he was first cousin to the late lamented Ethelwulf, whose body I had seen outside Redingham. "And now you," she turned to Breeder. "Father Beoka tells me you are niece to the holy King Edmund." Breeder just nodded. "But who are your parents?" Earlswith demanded, frowning. "Edmund had no brothers, and his 2 sisters are nuns." "Hild?" Breeder said. I knew that had been the name of her aunt, whom Breeder had hated.
"Hild?"
Earlswith was puzzled. More than puzzled, suspicious.
"Neither of good King Edmund's sisters are called Hild."
"I'm not his niece," Breeder confessed in a small voice.
"Ah."
Earlswith leaned back in her chair, her sharp face showing the look of satisfaction some people assume when they have caught a liar telling an untruth.
"But I was taught to call him uncle," Breeder went on,
surprising me, for I thought she had found herself in an impossible quandary and was confessing the lie. But instead I realised she was embroidering it. "My mother was called Hild, and she had no husband, but she insisted I call King Edmund uncle," she spoke in a small frightened voice. "And he liked that."
"He liked it?" Aelswith snapped. "Why?"
"Because," Breda said, and then blushed. And how she made herself blush, I do not know. But she lowered her eyes, reddened, and looked as if she were about to burst into tears.
"Ah,"
Aelswith said again, catching on to the girl's meaning and blushing herself.
"So he was your..."
She did not finish, not wanting to accuse the dead and holy King Edmund of having fathered a bastard on some woman called Hild.
"Yes,"
Breda said, and actually started crying. I stared up at the hall's smoke-blackened rafters and tried not to laugh.
"He was ever so kind to me," Breda sobbed, "and the nasty Danes killed him."
Aelswith plainly believed Breda. Folk usually do believe the worst in other folk, and the saintly King Edmund was now revealed as a secret womanizer, though that did not stop him eventually becoming a saint, but it did condemn Breda, because Aelswith now proposed that she be sent to some nunnery in southern Wessex. Breda might have royal blood, but it was plainly tainted by sin, so Aelswith wanted her locked away for life.
"Yes,"
Breda agreed meekly, and I had to pretend I was choking in the smoke. Then Aelswith presented us both with crucifixes. She had two ready, both of silver, but she whispered to one of the nuns, and a small wooden one was substituted for one of the silver crucifixes, and that one was presented to Breda, while I received a silver one, which I obediently hung about my neck. I kissed mine, which impressed Aelswith, and Breda hurriedly imitated me, but nothing she could do now would impress Alfred's wife. Breda was a self-condemned bastard. Alfred returned from Batham after nightfall, and I had to accompany him to church, where the prayers and praises went on forever. Four monks chanted, their droning voices half sending me to sleep, and afterward, for it did eventually end, I was invited to join Alfred for a meal. Beorca impressed on me that this was an honour, that not many folk were asked to eat with the king, but I had eaten with Danish chieftains, who never seemed to mind who shared their table, so long as they did not spit in the gruel, so I was not flattered. I was hungry, though. I could have eaten a whole roasted ox, and I was impatient as we ceremonially washed our hands in basins of water held by the servants, and then as we stood by our stools and chairs as Alfred and Aelswith were conducted to the table. A bishop allowed the food to cool, as he said an interminable prayer asking God to bless what we were about to eat, and then at last we sat. But what a disappointment that supper was. No pork, no beef, no mutton. Not a thing a man might want to eat, but only curds, leeks, soft eggs, bread, diluted ale and barley boiled into a jellied broth as palatable as frog spawn. Alfred kept saying how good it was, but in the end he did confess that he was afflicted with terrible pains in his belly, and that this pap-like diet kept the agony at bay. "The king is a martyr to meat," Beorca explained to me. He was one of the three priests at the high table, another of whom was a bishop who had no teeth and mashed his bread into the broth with a candlestick. And there were also two eldermen, and of course Aelswith, who did much of the talking. She was opposing the notion of allowing the Danes to stay in Reddingham, but in the end Alfred said he had no choice, and that it was a small concession to make for peace, and that ended the discussion. Aelswith did rejoice that her husband had negotiated the release of all the young hostages held by Halfdan's army, which Alfred had insisted on, for he feared those young ones would be led away from the true church. He looked at me as he spoke about that, but I took little notice, being far more interested in one of the servants who was a young girl, perhaps 4 or 5 years older than me, who was startlingly pretty with a mass of black ringleted hair. And I wondered if she was the girl who Alfred kept close, so he could thank God for giving him the strength to resist temptation. Later, much later, I discovered she was the same girl. Her name was Merwenna, and I thanked God in time for not resisting temptation with her. But that lies far ahead in my tale, and for now I was at Alfred's disposal, or rather at Elswith's.
"Uhtred must learn to read," she said. What business it was of hers I did not know, but no one disputed her statement.
"Amen," Beorka said.
"The monks at Winburnen can teach him," she suggested.
"A very good idea, my lady," Beorka said, and the toothless bishop nodded and dribbled his approval.
"Abbot Hewald is a very diligent teacher," Elswith said.
In truth, Abbot Hewald was one of those bastards who would rather whip the young than teach them, but doubtless that was what Elswith meant.
"I rather think," Alfred put in, "that young Uhtred's ambition is to be a warrior."
"In time, if God wills it, he will be," Elswith said. "But what use is a soldier who cannot read God's word?"
"Amen," Beorka said.
"No use at all," Alfred agreed.
I thought teaching a soldier to read was about as much use as teaching a dog to dance, but said nothing, though Alfred sensed my scepticism.
"Why is it good for a soldier to read, Uhtred?" he demanded of me.
"It is good for everyone to read," I said dutifully, earning a smile from Beorka.
"A soldier who reads," Alfred said patiently, "is a soldier who can read orders. A soldier who will know what his king wants. Suppose you are in Northumbria, Uhtred, and I am in Wessex. How else will you know my will?"
That was breathtaking, though I was too young to realise it at the time. If I was in Northumbria and he was in Wessex, then I was none of his damned business. But of course Alfred was already thinking ahead, far ahead, to a time when there would be one English kingdom and one English king. I just gaped at him, and he smiled at me. "So Winburnen it is, young man," he said, "and the sooner you are there, the better."
"The sooner?"
Elswith knew nothing of this suggested haste and was sharply suspicious.
"The Danes, my dear," Alfred explained, "will look for both children. If they discover they are here, they may well demand their return."
"But all hostages are to be freed," Elswith objected. "You said so yourself."
"Was Uhtred a hostage?" Alfred asked softly, staring at me. "Or was he in danger of becoming a Dane?"
He left the questions hanging, and I did not try to answer them.
"We must make you into a true Englishman," Alfred said. "So you must go south in the morning. You and the girl."
"The girl doesn't matter,"
Elswith said dismissively. Breda had been sent to eat with the kitchen slaves.
"If the Danes discover she's Edmund's bastard," one of the aldermen observed, "they'll use her to destroy his reputation."
"She never told them that," I piped up, "because she thought they might mock him."
"There's some good in her then,"
Elswith said grudgingly. She helped herself to one of the soft boiled eggs.
"But what will you do," she demanded of her husband, "if the Danes accuse you of rescuing the children?"
"I shall lie, of course," Alfred said.
Elswith blinked at him, but the bishop mumbled that the lie would be forgotten, so forgivable. I had no intention of going to Winburnen. That was not because I was suddenly avid to be a Dane, but it had everything to do with serpent breath. I loved that sword, and I had left it with Ragnar's servants, and I wanted her back before my life took whatever path the spinners required of me. And to be sure, I had no wish to give up life with Ragnar for the scant joys of a monastery and a teacher. Breda, I knew, wished to go back to the Danes, and it was Alfred's sensible insistence that we be removed from Batham as soon as possible that gave us our opportunity. We were sent away the next morning, before dawn, going south into a hilly country and escorted by a dozen warriors who resented the job of taking two children deep into the heartland of Wessex. I was given a horse. Breda was provided with a mule, and a young priest called Willibald was officially put in charge of delivering Breda to a nunnery and me to Abbot Hewald.
Father Willibald was a nice man, with an easy smile and a kind manner. He could imitate bird calls, and made us laugh by inventing a conversation between a quarrelsome field fare, with its chack-chack call, and a soaring skylark. Then he made us guess what birds he was imitating, and that entertainment, mixed in with some harmless riddles, took us to a settlement high above a soft-flowing river in the heavily wooded countryside. The soldiers insisted on stopping there because they said the horses needed a rest.
"They really need ale," Willibald told us, and shrugged as if it was understandable.
It was a warm day. The horses were hobbled outside the hall. The soldiers got their ale, bread and cheese, then sat in a circle and threw dice and grumbled, leaving us to Willibald's supervision. But the young priest stretched out on a half-collapsed haystack and fell asleep in the sunlight. I looked at Breda, she looked at me, and it was as simple as that. We crept along the side of the hall, circled an enormous dung heap, dodged through some pigs that rooted in a field, wriggled through a hedge, and then we were in woodland where we both started to laugh.
"My mother insisted I call him uncle," Breda said in her small voice, "and the nasty Danes killed him."
And we both thought that was the funniest thing we had ever heard. And then we came to our senses and hurried northward. It was a long time before the soldiers searched for us. And later they brought hunting dogs from the hall where they had purchased ale. But by then we had waded up a stream, changed direction again, found higher ground and hidden ourselves. They did not find us, though all afternoon we could hear the hounds baying in the valley. They must have been searching the riverbank, thinking we had gone there, but we were safe and alone and high. They searched for 2 days, never coming close. And on the third day, we saw Alfred's royal cavalcade riding south on the road under the hill. The meeting at Batham was over, and that meant the Danes were retreating to Reddingham. And neither of us had any idea how to reach Reddingham. But we knew we had travelled west to reach Batham, so that was a start. And we knew we had to find the River Thames, and our only two problems were food and the need to avoid being caught. That was a good time. We stole milk from the udders of cows and goats. We had no weapons, but we fashioned cudgels from fallen branches and used them to threaten some poor old man who was patiently digging a ditch and had a small sack with bread and peas pudding for his meal. And we stole that. And we caught fish with our hands, a trick that Breda taught me, and we lived in the woods. I wore my hammer amulet again. Breda had thrown away her wooden crucifix, but I kept the silver one, for it was valuable. After a few days, we began travelling by night. We were both frightened at first, for the night is when the Skeidugengen stir from their hiding places, but we became good at traversing the darkness. We skirted farms, following the stars, and we learned how to move without noise, how to be shadows. One night something large and growling came close, and we heard it shifting, pawing the ground. And we both beat at the leaf mould with our cudgels and yelped, and the thing went away. A boar? Perhaps. Or perhaps one of the shapeless, nameless Skeidugengen that curdle dreams. We had to cross a range of high, bare hills, where we managed to steal a lamb before the shepherd's dogs even knew we were there. We lit a fire in the woods north of the hills and cooked the meat, and the next night we found the river. We did not know what river, but it was wide. It flowed beneath deep trees, and nearby was a settlement where we saw a small round boat made of bent willow sticks covered with goatskin. That night, we stole the boat and let it carry us downstream, past settlements, under bridges ever going east. We did not know it, but the river was the Thames, and so we came safe to Reddingham. Rorik had died. He had been sick for so long, but there were times when he had seemed to recover. But whatever illness carried him away had done so swiftly, and Breda and I reached Reddingham on the day that his body was burned. Ragnar, in tears, stood by the pyre and watched as the flames consumed his son. A sword, a bridle, a hammer amulet and a model ship had been placed on the fire, and after it was done, the melted metal was placed with the ashes in a great pot that Ragnar buried close to the Thames. "You are my second son now," he told me that night, and then remembered Breda, "and you are my daughter." He embraced us both, then got drunk. The next morning he wanted to ride out and kill West Saxons, but Ravan and Halfdan restrained him. The truce was holding. Breda and I had only been gone a little over 3 weeks, and already the first silver was coming to Redingham, along with fodder and food. Alfred, it seemed, was a man of his word, and Ragnar was a man of grief. "How will I tell Sigrid?" he wanted to know.
"It is bad for a man to have only one son," Ravan told me. "Almost as bad as having none. I had 3, but only Ragnar lives. Now only his eldest lives."
Ragnar the younger was still in Ireland.
"He can have another son," Breda said.
"Not from Sigrid," Ravan said. "But he could take a second wife, I suppose. It is sometimes done."
Ragnar had given me back serpent breath, and another arm ring. He gave a ring to Breda too, and he took some consolation from the story of our escape. We had to tell it to Halfdan, and to Guthrum the Unlucky, who stared at us dark-eyed as we described the meal with Alfred, and Alfred's plans to educate me, and even grief-stricken Ragnar laughed when Breda retold the story of how she had claimed to be King Edmund's bastard.
"This Queen Aelswyth," Halfdan wanted to know, "what is she like?"
"No queen," I said. "The West Saxons won't have queens. Beorca had told me that. She is merely the king's wife."
"She is a weasel pretending to be a thrush," Breda said.
"Is she pretty?"
Guthrum asked.
"A pinched face," Breda said, "and piggy eyes and a pursed mouth."
"He'll get no joy there then," Halfdan said.
"Why did he marry her?"
"Because she's from Mercia," Ravan said, "and Alfred would have Mercia on his side."
"Mercia belongs to us," Halfdan growled.
"But Alfred would take it back," Ravan said. "And what we should do is send ships with rich gifts for the Britons. If they attack from Wales and Cornwallum, then he must divide his army."
That was an unfortunate thing to say, for Halfdan still smarted from the memory of dividing his own army at Aske's Hill, and he just scowled into his ale. So far as I know, he never did send gifts to the Britons, and it would have been a good idea if he had, but he was distracted by his failure to take Wessex, and there were rumours of unrest in both Northumbria and Mercia. The Danes had captured so much of England so quickly that they had never really subdued their conquest, nor did they hold all the fortresses in the conquered land, and so revolts flared like heathland fires. They were easily put down, but untended they would spread and become dangerous. It was time, Halfdan said, to stamp on the fires and to cow the conquered English into terrified submission. Once that was done, once Northumbria, Mercia, and East Anglia were quiet, the attack on Wessex could be resumed. The last of Alfred's silver came, and the Danish army released the young hostages, including the Mercian twins, and the rest of us went back to Lundane. Ragnar dug up the pot with his younger son's ashes and carried it downstream on Wind Viper. "I shall take it home," he told me, "and bury him with his own people." We could not travel north that year. It was autumn when we reached Lundane, and so we had to wait through the winter, and it was not till spring that Ragnar's 3 ships left the Thames and sailed north. I was 15 then, and growing fast, so that I was suddenly a head taller than most men, and Ragnar made me take the steering oar. He taught me to guide a ship, how to anticipate the buffet of wind or wave, and how to heave on the steering oar before the ship veered. I learned the subtle touch, though at first the ship swayed drunkenly as I put too much pressure on the oar. But in time I came to feel the ship's will in the long oar's shaft, and learned to love the quiver in the ash as the sleek hull gained her full speed.
"I shall make you my second son," Ragnar told me on that voyage. I did not know what to say. "I shall always favour my eldest," he went on, meaning Ragnar the younger, "but you shall still be as a son to me."
"I would like that," I said, awkwardly. I gazed at the distant shore that was flecked by the little dun sails of the fishing boats that were fleeing from our ships.
"I am honoured," I said. "Uthred Ragnarsson," he said, trying it out. And he must have liked the sound of it, for he smiled.
But then he thought of Rorik again, and the tears came to his eyes, and he just stared eastward into the empty sea. That night we slept in the mouth of the Humber, and 2 days later came back to Jofurik. The king's palace had been repaired. It had new shutters on its high windows, and the roof was freshly thatched with golden rye straw. The palace's old Roman walls had been scrubbed so that the lichen was gone from the joints between the stones. Guards stood at the outer gate, and when Ragnar demanded entry, they curtly told him to wait, and I thought he would draw his sword. But before his anger could erupt, Kjartan appeared.
"My lord Ragnar," he said sourly. "Since when does a Dane wait at this gate?" Ragnar demanded. "Since I ordered it," Kjartan retorted, and there was insolence in his voice. He, like the palace, looked prosperous. He wore a cloak of black bear fur, had tall boots, a chainmail tunic, a red leather sword belt, and almost as many arm rings as Ragnar. "No one enters here without my permission," Kjartan went on. "But, of course, you are welcome, Earl Ragnar." He stepped aside to let Ragnar, myself, and three of Ragnar's men into the big hall, where 5 years before my uncle had tried to buy me from Ivar. "I see you still have your English pet," Kjartan said, looking at me. "Go on seeing while you have eyes," Ragnar said carelessly. "Is the king here?" "He only grants audience to those people who arrange to see him," Kjartan said. Ragnar sighed and turned on his erstwhile shipmaster. "You itch me like a louse," he said, "and if it pleases you, Kjartan, we shall lay the hazel rods and meet man to man. And if that does not please you, then fetch the king, because I would speak with him." Kjartan bridled, but decided he did not want to face Ragnar's sword in a fighting space marked by hazel branches, and so with an ill grace he went into the palace's back rooms. He made us wait long enough, but eventually King Egbert appeared, and with him were 6 guards, who included one-eyed Sven, who now looked as wealthy as his father. Big, too, almost as tall as I was, with a broad chest and hugely muscled arms. Egbert looked nervous, but did his best to appear regal. Ragnar bowed to him, then said there were tales of unrest in Northumbria and that Halfdan had sent him north to quell any such disturbances. "There is no unrest," Egbert said, but in such a frightened voice that I thought he would piss his breeches. "There were disturbances in the inland hills," Kjartan said dismissively, "but they ended." He patted his sword to show what had ended them. Ragnar persevered, but learned nothing more. A few men had evidently risen against the Danes. There had been ambushes on the road leading to the west coast. The perpetrators had been hunted down and killed, and that was all Kjartan would say. "Northumbria is safe," he finished. "So you can return to Halfdan, my lord, and keep on trying to defeat Wessex." Ragnar ignored that last barb. "I shall go to my home," he said,
bury my son and live in peace. Sven was fingering his sword hilt and looking at me sourly with his one eye. But while the enmity between us and between Ragnar and Kjartan was obvious, no one made trouble, and we left. The ships were hauled onto shore, the silver fetched from Redingham was shared out among the crews, and we went home carrying Rorik's ashes. Sigrid wailed at the news. She tore her dress and tangled her hair and screamed. The other women joined her, and a procession carried Rorik's ashes to the top of the nearest hill where the pot was buried. Afterward, Ragnar stayed there, looking across the hills and watching the white clouds sail across the western sky. We stayed home all the rest of that year. There were crops to grow, hay to cut, a harvest to reap and to grind. We made cheese and butter. Merchants and travellers brought news, but none from Wessex, where it seemed Alfred still ruled and had his peace. And so that kingdom remained the last one of England. Ragnar sometimes spoke of returning there, carrying his sword to gain more riches. But the fight seemed to have gone from him that summer. He sent a message to Ireland asking that his eldest son come home, but such messages were not reliable, and Ragnar the younger did not come that year. Ragnar also thought of Thyra, his daughter. "He says it's time I married," she said to me one day as we churned butter. "You?" I laughed. "I'm nearly 13," she said defiantly. "So you are. Who'll marry you?" She shrugged. "Mother likes Anwend." Anwend was one of Ragnar's warriors, a young man not much older than me, strong and cheerful. But Ragnar had an idea she should marry one of Ubba's sons. But that would mean she would go away, and Sigrid hated that thought, and Ragnar slowly came around to Sigrid's way of thinking. I liked Anwend, and thought he would make a good husband for Thyra, who was growing ever more beautiful. She had long golden hair, wide-set eyes, a straight nose, unscarred skin, and a laugh that was like a ripple of sunshine. "Mother says I must have many sons," she said. "I hope you do." "I'd like a daughter too," she said, straining with the churn because the butter was solidifying and the work getting harder. "Mother says Breda should marry as well." "Breda might have different ideas," I said. "She wants to marry you," Thyra said. I laughed at that. I thought of Breda as a friend, my closest friend, and just because we slept with each other, or we did when Sigrid was not watching, did not make me want to marry her. I did not want to marry at all. I thought only of swords and shields and battles. And Breda thought of herbs. She was like a cat. She came and went secretly, and she learned all that Sigrid could teach her about herbs and their uses. Bindweed as a purgative, toad flax for ulcers, marsh marigold to keep elves away from the milk pails, chickweed for coughs, cornflower for fevers, and she learned other spells she would not tell me, women's spells, and said that if you stayed silent in the night, unmoving, scarce breathing, the spirits would come. And Raven taught her how to dream with the gods, which meant drinking ale in which pounded red-cap mushrooms had been steeped. And she was often ill, for she drank it too strong. But she would not stop. And she made her first songs then, songs about birds and about beasts. And Raven said she was a true scald. Some nights, when we watched the charcoal burn, she would recite to me, her voice soft and rhythmic. She had a dog now that followed her everywhere. She had found him in Lundain on our homeward journey, and he was black and white, as clever as Breda herself, and she called him Nightganger, which means nightwalker or goblin. He would sit with us by the charcoal pyre, and I swear he listened to her songs. Breda made pipes from straw and played melancholy tunes, and Nightganger would watch her with big sad eyes until the music overcame him, and then he would raise his muzzle and howl. And we would both laugh, and Nightganger would be offended, and Breda would have to pet him back to happiness. We forgot the war, until when the summer was at its height and a pall of heat lay over the hills, we had an unexpected visitor. Earl Guthrum the Unlucky came to our remote valley. He came with 20 horsemen, all dressed in black, and he bowed respectfully to Sigrid, who chided him for not sending warning. "I would have made a feast," she said. "I brought food," Guthrum said, pointing to some pack horses. "I did not want to empty your stores." He had come from distant Lundain, wanting to talk with Ragnar and Ravin, and Ragnar invited me to sit with them because, he said, I knew more than most men about Wessex, and Wessex was what Guthrum wished to talk about, though my contribution was small. I described Alfred, described his piety, and warned Guthrum that though the West Saxon king was not an impressive man to look at, he was undeniably clever. Guthrum shrugged at that. "Cleverness is overrated," he said gloomily. "Clever doesn't win battles."
"Stupidity loses them," Ravin put in. "Like dividing the army when we fought outside Ebbandunna."
Guthrum scowled, but decided not to pick a fight with Ravin, and instead asked Ragnar's advice on how to defeat the West Saxons, and demanded Ragnar's assurance that come the new year, Ragnar would bring his men to Lundain and join the next assault.
"If it is next year," Guthrum said gloomily.
He scratched at the back of his neck, jiggling his mother's gold-tipped bone that still hung from his hair.
"We may not have sufficient men."
"Then we will attack the year after," Ragnar said.
"Or the one after that," Guthrum said, then frowned. "But how do we finish the pious bastard?"
"Split his forces," Ragnar said, "because otherwise we'll always be outnumbered."
"Always outnumbered?"
Guthrum looked dubious at that assertion.
"When we fought here," Ragnar said, "some Northumbrians decided not to fight us, and they took refuge in Mercia.
When we fought in Mercia and East Anglia, the same thing happened, and men fled from us to find sanctuary in Wessex. But when we fight in Wessex, they have nowhere to go. No place is safe for them. So they must fight, all of them. Fight in Wessex, and the enemy is cornered."
"And a cornered enemy," Ravin put in, "is dangerous."
"Split them," Guthrum said pensively, ignoring Ravin again.
"Ships on the south coast," Ragnar suggested, "an army on the Thames, and British warriors coming from Brychenjog, Glusing, and Gwent." Those were the southern Welsh kingdoms where the Britons lurked beyond Mercia's western border.
"Three attacks," Ragnar went on, "and Alfred will have to deal with them all, and he won't be able to do it."
"And you will be there?" Guthrum asked.
"You have my word," Ragnar said. And then the conversation turned to what Guthrum had seen on his journey, and admittedly he was a pessimistic man and prone to see the worst in everything, but he despaired of England. "There was trouble in Mercia," he said, "and the East Anglians were restless, and now there was talk that King Egbert in Jofrek was encouraging revolt."
"Egbert?"
Ragnar was surprised at the news.
"He couldn't encourage a peace out of a drunk man."
"It's what I'm told," Guthrum said. "May not be true. Fellow Kutkjartan told me."
"Then it's almost certainly not true."
"Not true at all," Ravin agreed.
"He seemed like a good man to me," Guthrum said, obviously unaware of Ragnar's history with Kjartan, and Ragnar did not enlighten him, and probably forgot the conversation once Guthrum had travelled on.
Yet Guthrum had been right. Plotting was going on in Jofrek, though I doubt it was Egbert who did it. Kjartan did it. And he started by spreading rumours that King Egbert was secretly organising a rebellion. And the rumours became so loud, and the king's reputation so poisoned, that one night Egbert, fearing for his life, managed to evade his Danish guards and flee south with a dozen companions. He took shelter with King Burgred of Mercia, who, though his country was occupied by Danes, had been allowed to keep his own household guard that was sufficient to protect his new guest. Riksig of Dunholm, the man who had handed the captured monks to Ragnar, was declared the new king of Northumbria, and he rewarded Kjartan by allowing him to ravage any place that might have harboured rebels in league with Egbert. There had been no rebellion, of course, but Kjartan had invented one, and he savaged the few remaining monasteries and nunneries in Northumbria, thus becoming even wealthier, and he stayed as Riksig's chief warrior and tax collector. All this passed us by. We brought in the harvest, feasted, and it was announced that at Yule there would be a wedding between Thyra and Anwend. Ragnar asked Eldwulf the smith to make Anwend a sword as fine as serpent breath, and Eldwulf said he would, and at the same time make me a short sword of the kind Toki had recommended for fighting in the shield wall, and he made me help him beat out the twisted rods. All that autumn we worked until Eldwulf had made Anwend's sword, and I had helped make my own sax. I called her Wasp Sting because she was short, and I could not wait to try her out on an enemy, which Eldwulf said was foolishness.
"Enemies come soon enough in a man's life," he told me. "You don't need to seek them out."
I made my first shield in the early winter, cutting the limewood, forging the great boss with its handle that was held through a hole in the wood, painting it black and rimming it with an iron strip. It was much too heavy, that shield, and later I learned how to make them lighter. But as the autumn came, I carried shield, sword and sax everywhere, accustoming myself to their weight, practicing the strokes and parries, dreaming. I half feared and half longed for my first shield wall, for no man was a warrior until he had fought in the shield wall, and no man was a real warrior until he had fought in the front rank of the shield wall, and that was Death's Kingdom, the place of horror. But like a fool, I aspired to it. And we readied ourselves for war. Ragnar had promised his support to Guthrum, and so Breeder and I made more charcoal, and Eldwulf hammered out spear points and axe heads and spades, while Sigrid found joy in the preparations for Thyra's wedding. There was a betrothal ceremony at the beginning of winter when Anwend, dressed in his best clothes that were neatly darned, came to our hall with six of his friends, and he shyly proposed himself to Ragnar as Thyra's husband. Everyone knew he was going to be her husband, but the formalities were important, and Thyra sat between her mother and father as Anwend promised Ragnar that he would love, cherish and protect Thyra, and then proposed a bride price of 20 pieces of silver, which was much too high, but which I suppose meant he really loved Thyra. "Make it 10, Anwend," Ragnar said, generous as ever, "and spend the rest on a new coat."
20 is good, Sigrid said firmly, for the bride price, though given to Ragnar, would become Thyra's property once she was married.
"Then have Thyra give you a new coat," Ragnar said, taking the money. And then he embraced Anwend.
And there was a feast, and Ragnar was happier that night than he had been since Rorik's death. Thyra watched the dancing, sometimes blushing as she met Anwen's eyes. Anwen's six friends, all warriors of Ragnar, would come back with him for the wedding, and they would be the men who would watch Anwend take Thyra to his bed, and only when they reported that she was a proper woman would the marriage be deemed to have taken place. But those ceremonies would have to wait until Yule. Thyra would be wedded then. We would have our feast. The winter would be endured. We would go to war. In other words, we thought the world would go on as it ever did. And at the foot of Yggdrasil, the tree of life, the three spinners mocked us. I spent many Christmases at the West Saxon court. Christmas is Yule with religion, and the West Saxons managed to spoil the midwinter feast with chanting monks, droning priests, and savagely long sermons. Yule is supposed to be a celebration and a consolation, a moment of warm brightness in the heart of winter, a time to eat because you know that the lean times are coming when food will be scarce and ice locks the land, and a time to be happy and get drunk and behave irresponsibly and wake up the next morning wondering if you will ever feel well again. But the West Saxons handed the feast to the priests, who made it as joyous as a funeral. I have never really understood why people think religion has a place in the midwinter feast, though of course the Danes remembered their gods at that time and sacrificed to them, but they also believed Odin, Thor, and the other gods were all feasting in Asgard and had no wish to spoil the feasts in Midgard, our world. That seems sensible. But I have learned that most Christians are fearfully suspicious of enjoyment, and Yule offered far too much of that for their taste. Some folk in Wessex knew how to celebrate it, and I always did my best. But if Alfred was anywhere close, then you could be sure that we were required to fast, pray, and repent through the whole 12 days of Christmas. Which is all by way of saying that the Yule feast where Thyra would be married was to be the greatest in Danish memory. We worked hard as it approached. We kept more animals alive than usual, and slaughtered them just before the feast so that their meat would not need to be salted. And we dug great pits where the pigs and cows would be cooked on huge gridirons that Eldwulf made. He grumbled about it, saying that forging cooking implements took him away from his real work. But he secretly enjoyed it, because he loved his food. As well as pork and beef, we planned to have herring, salmon, mutton, pike, freshly baked bread, cheese, ale, mead, and best of all, the puddings that were made by stuffing sheep intestines with blood, offal, oats, horseradish, wild garlic and juniper berries. I loved those puddings, and still do, all crisp on the outside but bursting with warm blood when you bite into them. I remember Alfred grimacing with distaste as I ate one, and as the bloody juices ran into my beard. But then he was sucking on a boiled leek at the time. We planned sports and games. The lake in the heart of the valley had frozen, and I was fascinated by the way the Danes strapped bones to their feet and glided on the ice, a pastime that lasted until the ice broke and a young man drowned. But Ragnar reckoned the lake would be hard frozen again after Yule, and I was determined to learn the skill of ice gliding. For the moment, though, Breeder and I were still making charcoal for Eldwulf, who had decided to make Ragnar a sword, the finest he had ever made, and we were charged with turning 2 wagon loads of alderwood into the best possible fuel. We planned to break the pile the day before the feast, but it was bigger than any we had made before, and it was still not cool enough, and if you break a pile before it is ready, then the fire will flare up with terrible force and burn all the half-made charcoal into ash, and so we made certain every vent was properly sealed, and reckoned we would have time to break it on Yule morning before the celebrations began. Most of Ragnar's men and their families were already at the hall, sleeping wherever they could find shelter, and ready for the first meal of the day, and for the games that would take place in the meadow before the marriage ceremony. But Breeder and I spent that last night up at the pile, for fear that some animal would scratch through the turf, and so start a draught that would revive the burn. I had serpent breath and wasp sting, for I would go nowhere without them, and Breeder had Neatgenger, for she would go nowhere without him, and we were both swathed in furs because the night was cold. When a pile was burning, you could rest on the turf and feel the heat, but not that night because the fire was almost gone.
End of Disc 7.